So just to kind of get into this, so what we see here on the left, if I turn this microphone, do you think that'll still work? It's kind of hard for me to stand behind the podium. So what we see here on the left is sort of a typical agricultural monoculture where you just have the crop plant and then bare earth in between the rows. And of course, there's really not much of habitat here for natural enemies. So what we then try to do within conservation biocontrol type schemes is try to come up with some way to diversify this habitat and provide more habitat for natural enemies. And one of the simplest things that people have tried is the installation of beetle banks. So here's a field with a beetle bank right here. Beetle bank is just a strip of grass that runs down the center of the field. So the idea is basically, otherwise the sort of the nearest natural habitat is the field margin, so you just run a field margin down the center of the field. And the idea is that this might conserve ground and rove beetles and some other generalist predators that are mostly active on the ground. So there's been a lot of work in Europe showing that when you install these beetle banks, you see an increase in densities of ground active predators. But what's less often also followed up on is then to see if pest control actually improves. Okay, so here's the system that we were working in. So the target crop here is a radish root, and this is the root maggot, which is the pest that we're dealing with. And these are fly larvae that feed on the roots of these plants. Here's a radish that has not been attacked by the root maggot, and here's a radish that has. And the growers find that the radish on the left is more marketable when they try to go in. So it's a pretty big pest, especially if that level of damage. And this is a type of pest where we thought that these ground active predators might be really effective biocontrol agents, because the flies come along and they lay their eggs right at the base of the plant, and then the newly hatching larvae kind of burrow down and feed on the roots. So perfect placement of the pest where you might expect for ground beetles to be effective natural enemies against this pest. So maybe a good target to be conserved and have biocontrol improved using beetle banks. Okay, well, we thought from the start there could be some trouble in this system as well. So this is the community of ground beetles that we find. We find just one really large species, Taurasticus melanarius. It's about a centimeter and a half in length. And this is an exotic species that was introduced from Europe. And then these are all the native predators, which are some smaller beetles, about less than a centimeter in length, ground and rove beetles also. So it's sort of a diverse community of native species that are really small, and this sort of big, kind of nasty exotic. These root maggot eggs are really, really tiny, and the larvae are really tiny. So in laboratory feeding trials, we had found that it's mostly these smaller predators that are the effective biocontrol agents of the root maggots. And so you can see there could be some potential for some intraguild predation in a system like this, because the Taurasticus melanarius, for the most part, the fly eggs are too small to really draw their attention. Okay, we had a series of central questions here. So first of all, we wanted to try out these beetle banks for ourselves in Washington and see if they work, see if we get higher densities of ground beetles, but then also follow up and take the next step and see if with higher densities of ground beetles, do we also see improved biocontrol? And then even finally, the third kind of big step there is if it does work, why? If it doesn't work, why not? And try to get some better idea of what's the ecology of the system to try to get some more general principles. And I keep saying we in this case, but we was really Renee Prasad, who was a PhD student with me a couple years ago. Here's Renee and I sort of searching for ground beetles through one of her beetle banks. This, first of all, you can just see what the beetle banks look like. It's just a strip of grass. We used orchard grass. And so here was the crop, and here's sort of a bare field. We installed one of these on the research farm, but then the other four, I guess, were on real grower farms. These are small acreage organic vegetable farms in western Washington. So we installed these beetle banks, we monitored beetle densities, and then also measured predation on sentinel fly eggs. Okay, first of all, we did find that these beetle banks were really effective at conserving ground beetles, so really similar to what they've seen in the European work. So what I'm showing here is, first of all, through the season, May, August, September. On the top I've got the small beetles, first two panels. On the lower two panels I've got Taurasticus melanarius, which is this really large beetle, and then this is total activity density per field. The blue lines are showing fields with beetle banks, and the black lines are control fields, also farmer-managed fields, but that didn't include a beetle bank. And what you can see across both types of beetles and throughout the season is that, for the most part, beetle densities were higher in fields that included beetle banks. The statistics of this are a little bit complicated. Sometimes there are some treatment by time interactions and things, but the overall trend across both taxa was to see increased densities, and sometimes it was quite dramatic. If you look at Taurasticus melanarius densities here, are far higher in fields including beetle banks. So really good evidence that we're able to reproduce what they see in Europe with effective conservation. Of course, the next step that Renee took then was to see, do you actually see improved biocontrol? So what she did was she went into these fields, and in the field adjacent to the beetle bank, she put out sentinel root maggot fly eggs. I think actually she used, she actually used house fly eggs, which are sort of a surrogate because they were easy to manage, but fly eggs she put out in the field and then measured predation. So what we have here is small beetle activity density, Trostichus millenarius activity density, and through some of the different months that we did this sampling. And the overall trend here is not for any month or for any taxon do we see significant relationship between activity densities of the beetles and predation on these fly eggs. So while we're seeing really dramatic improvement in densities of the beetles, we see no correlation between beetle density and predation on the fly eggs. So on the one hand, the beetle banks are really effective at conserving densities of the beetles, but on the other hand, we saw no improvement in control. So the next step then was to try to get some understanding of why. What might be the ecological interactions that are causing this conservation biocontrol that on the one hand is successful to actually fail in conserving or improving biological control? Okay, so through a series of experiments that Renee had done, there were two interactions that we thought might be disrupting control in the system. The one I've already alluded to, which is that we have these giant Trostichus beetles that might be feeding on the smaller ground beetles. Another one that kind of popped up is she had one experiment where she had an unexpected or unplanned outbreak of aphids, green peach aphids, and we also saw reduced control in that experiment. So we wanted to run a series of experiments, though, to really kind of pin down these interactions. And I'm going to talk about those two experiments next. Okay, the first thing is she wanted to see, is there interference between Trostichus millenarius and the smaller beetles? Here's kind of the three main experimental treatments. We had a no intraguild predator, low intraguild predator, and high density of the intraguild predator. So all cages received these smaller beetles, and then we manipulated the densities of the Trostichus, the potential intraguild predator, 0, 7, or 28 beetles per cage. Talk more about the details. Oh, well, here actually is a picture of the cage. These are these 2 by 2 by 2 meter field cages, kind of our standard experimental units in my lab. Okay, we had 5 replicates per treatment. I've already shown you the cages. And we did 2 blocks separate in time because it was kind of a big experiment and she couldn't really handle all the cages at once. I'm just going to show you the data from one of these blocks, though, today, although they were pretty similar between the two. The results are pretty similar between the two. And we had groups of 20 fly eggs added to measure predation. Sentinel eggs were put out again on days 4, 6, and 8. I'm just going to show you the average across those samples. We used house fly eggs, again, as a surrogate because they're easy to rear. And predator densities were measured at the experiment's end using pitfall traps, so a measure to see if the presence of the intraguild predator would change the density of the smaller beetles. Okay, so here are the data. First of all, this is the 0, 1x, and 4x intraguild predators densities. Then we have 3 panels. The first is activity densities of Trostichus millenarius, the intraguild predator. What we can see is we were quite effective at manipulating their densities and establishing a low versus a high density of this predator. Then we next have activity densities of the small beetles, the ones that are the main biocontrol agents. What we did see is that in any of the 2 treatments that included Trostichus millenarius, their activity densities were reduced. So there was evidence of some type of interference. At the time, we thought that this was intraguild predation, but some later experiments that Renee did suggested that actually the small beetles are just kind of afraid of the large beetles and they hide in their holes or whatever and don't forage as much. So probably not actually intraguild predation, but predator interference. And then eggs eaten, indeed, at least at the highest densities of Trostichus millenarius, we saw disrupted predation of these root maggot eggs by the small ground beetles.
Sound familiar?
Yeah, it does. Yeah, that reminds me of 4 o'clock in the morning last night. I wish that was a joke. Okay, back to this. Let me focus again here. Okay, then the second one was do alternative prey disrupt biocontrol? The same general design, except here the interference agent were aphids, so we had low and high densities of aphids. First of all, so we're showing activity densities of small beetles on the left and eggs eaten on the right. No low or high aphids. There's no evidence that aphids influenced activity patterns of the smaller beetles, but we did see a trend towards general disruption, a significant difference between high and no aphid densities in the rates of egg predation. So egg predation was also suppressed in the presence of aphids. Of course, in these real fields, these real production fields, aphids are almost always present. So just to conclude, beetle densities increased in fields with these beetle banks, but we saw no evidence in the field that a biocontrol of our root maggot targets is actually improved. Smaller beetles reduce their consumption of eggs when aphids are present, and also in the presence of Pterostachys melanarius, this kind of scary intraguild predator. So I guess what we conclude from this is that there may be really some strong ecological challenges to try to do conservation biocontrol with generalist predators, because even when you increase the densities of the predators, there's so many things out there that can distract them that you might not see improved control at the end. Okay, and our funding was provided by USDA, SARE, I want to make sure to point out. And thanks for your attention. I don't know if we have time for questions. Okay, thank you. Yes?
What is the abundance of the European
That's a good question. The question was, what is the relative abundance of the exotic versus the natives? Well, if I ran back and look at the axis, I could probably tell you exactly, but my general impression, they're probably about roughly equal. The Pterostachys is probably about equal to the total density of the smaller beetles, I would say. They have different activity patterns, so the small beetles are active more early in the year, and Pterostachys is more active later on in the year. And I guess what we don't know is if that was always the case, or if the small beetles are actually doing this hiding behavior later on when Pterostachys is very active. Yeah, Pedro.
I'm assuming you focused on the eggs because of the need for high quality product. Is it possible that part of the issue is that they may be more effective at eating larvae than eggs, or prefer larvae over eggs, or species, or something like that?
Yeah, the question is, were we just maybe looking at the wrong life stage? We're not sure. I mean, we picked the eggs because their placement is so ideal for where the ground beetles are foraging, because it's actually sort of right on the surface of the ground. But we didn't look at the larvae. The other reason is just a logistical one, that the larvae are so hard to track. And, you know, you can't go out into the grower's fields and release root maggot larvae, you know, and then count them later because their heads will kind of explode. So by using the domestic housefly eggs, at least we weren't introducing a pest and all that. So that's sort of a long way of saying we don't know because we didn't check that. Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you.